The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Hi, friends. Good evening here. And we're continuing our work with identifying. Now, some fine philosophers have written on this subject of being. They didn't necessarily have an esoteric background, but they certainly had the intellect. I'm trying to think of I know Jean-Paul Sartre, he was very third ray, and there was another German philosopher recently, and for some reason his name is skipping my mind, but anyway, he wrote extensively on this subject. I guess the main thing is to, in those everyday activities, which are so oppressive at times and so demanding, to somehow see from another point of view simultaneously. And actually, it's not even a point of view. We have difficulties when we try to see through one point. Although, you know, Leibniz, it's actually not pronounced Nitz, it's Niz. A great genius, he really was. And certainly on the third ray, he considered in some respect that a monad was a point of view. And he individualized the monad, and he did not imagine, or at least he didn't write about, the overcoming of the of monadic boundaries. And we're going to think a little bit about boundaries here. And I just want to say also, please check out the chat box, because we have you know, pretty well, you have these things because they are continuous. The links are continuous, but check it out, because tomorrow morning we do have science of triangles, and I think let's see, Michael. Yeah, we have the full moon coming up, and the full moon is actually on the 9th. And they're always broadcast, and they always have music, and it will be 1 hour before the actual full moon, which is at 7:33 and 8 seconds. We also have the pre-full moon the night before, and that seems to be invariably at 8 o'clock GMT. So and that's always a webinar, and you'll be able to check out what it is, but I think Michael's put it in there for you. And when I sometimes can, assuming that people do go occasionally to the YouTube, I try to put underneath the picture the link for any other webinar that's coming up. I don't know if I've done that this time, but that's one place to check, but also right on the, what is it, Joe? Is it Makara that you check for these links? Is that correct? Okay, I think Joe must be somewhere else here, but
there will probably be information posted on MoriaFederation.com.
Okay, because I also know that, yeah, all right. Well, one of our websites is going to have it. Either MoriaFederation.com or Makara will have it, you know, for those of you who are attending. And we, next Monday again, is it? I think so, yeah. The 10th, we're going to have another Esoteric United Nations meeting, where a few people take their pledges and we discuss maybe some of the countries. I think today too, is it the USA today or is it Indonesia, do you know? I think we did India yesterday.
The USA is today.
Okay. All right, lots going on there for sure that is decisive in terms of the quality of the American experience and the return of the Christ and lots of importance in terms of the expression of the secondary soul of America and by association, the secondary soul of the United Kingdom. We've got a lot of energies floating around here, you know, and the Tibetan is helping us stand on the mountaintop and look up into the sky and become the astonished, he says, either astounded or astonished disciples, seeing the rivers and streams of energy and all the things that they anticipate for the development of man. So when you're studying with the Tibetan, it's I oftentimes say, well, there's a fourth force in psychology, which has brought us into what you call transpersonal psychology. And Carl Jung kind of got into that, not Freud so much, but Carl Jung and the Abraham Maslow and the self-realization groups. But the Tibetan has taken it definitely one step further. And he has said, look, now let's learn the energies that are associated with this higher or transpersonal self. And right there comes all of the interest, all the articulation, all the astrology and rheology and those things that, are considered technical. And okay, they are technical, and a lot of people don't want to bother their head about it, but it is important, you know. So especially if you want to be the kind of esotericist that will really be helpful in the future. I mean, it's all kinds of lines of esotericism that can be helpful, but DK's particular abilities, who knows what other abilities, but his presentations have to do with these are the two words, meticulous entirety of the second ray. So if you have the Alice Bailey CD-ROM, just look up meticulous entirety and ponder on that, because he's opening the door for us to that particular type of apprehension. Even though we are in the veil of illusion, inevitably, as apparently differentiated beings. See, this whole project that we're working on right now is how to learn how to overcome differentiation. Think of that. Overcome differentiation while in a practical way maintaining the illusion of it. So there is the illusion of differentiation, and things are apparently different from other things. And at the same time, we have to say, wait a second, it is a very present illusion cyclically occurring. Remember Shankaracharya, most mysterious is Maya and forever. When I read that, I just about fell off the floor, you know. Oh, well, maybe I was on the floor already. Fell off the chair. And I thought, yeah, it really is mysterious, because out of this absolute infinitude of possibilities which precedes every universe, one set is selected, which is a, you might say, a finitization of the smallest sector of absolute infinity. I mean, everything's possible, and not only is it, well, not everything, maybe, that there's some discussion there about whether you can ever negate the non-negatable, whether you can ever negate the one and only thing. And that's why Spinoza was so careful in his definitions of God, because he just didn't want negation introduced. That's the one thing that seems impossible to do, even though it's out of reach from the apprehension, the registration, the perception of any being, because there is no division in it. So you'd have to have like a viewer and the viewed, the perceiver and the perceived, which is not possible in that great beingness or beingness. Even though you have to have that, we find another place for it, not within the absoluteness, which always has been and never was caused, always has been. We find that the first example of the perceiver and the perceived is the absolute deity, which, you know, knowing, of course, this is a little ridiculous, but one step lower than absoluteness. Why should a person care about all this? Because this is what we are. We can pretend, you know, with drawings like this, that look at all that differentiation, every sphere being like a different type of being, and we can pretend that somehow they are really different from each other. And Leibniz would say, yeah, they are different from each other. But we're taking the Vedantic position that they're not different from each other. And in a way, your identity keeps getting closer and closer to the real as these little balls start to coalesce. See, like, I'm going to bring this up tonight and ask you a couple of questions, what you think. But the whole issue of boundaries and who we are really, because so often we define our identity by the idea of a boundary. And remember, when you think about that fact, we are also faced with what's called the boundless, immutable principle. I seem to have a little... Okay, the boundless, immutable principle. And we're going to deal with boundlessness and the implications of boundedness and boundlessness. And I think they are very profound implications. Frankly, we are the, you and I and everything, essentially we are the unbounded absolute. Now maybe you'd rather be something else. Maybe you'd rather be a human being, just a human being, you know, living here, studying that, looking like this or that, wearing this or that. Maybe that's what you'd rather be. And because it's a little closer the home and easier to deal with. But, and I wish I could think of it more often when I'm stressed or in difficult situations, that really I am, and you are, and everybody is, and everything is, the unbounded absoluteness. And I want to call it also the unarticulated absoluteness. You know what articulation is? Articulation in music, that's where I'm most familiar with it, is a kind of a marking. It can be a staccato, it can be a marcato, it can be an accent, it can be a big accent, you know. It separates one thing from another. When you have articulated notes, you don't have legato. See, it just goes on and on and on. Legato means tied to each other. So that's a very smooth kind of presentation. But when you have articulation, then everything is separated out. And you really hear each note distinctly. Not so beautiful when you want to evoke really deep and smooth passions and reflective understanding. Not so much that. The legato is better there. But when you want excitement, oftentimes it's best to have the articulation. Well, so that's how I use the word articulation. Okay, it's and when I say that absoluteness is absolutely unarticulated, I mean there's just no separation in it, and and this is the crazy thing, you know, no extension in it, even though it's boundless. Because, you know, extension means you have to measure something against something else to see how extended it is. But there isn't. There's no extension in it. And also, there's no time in it. You cannot measure the time that absoluteness has existed. And in the same way, you cannot measure the time that the essential you has existed. I guess all you can say is like forever. And when you start to think about that forever idea, it does strange things, I think, to the thinking apparatus, and everything of moment begins to disappear. And other things take its place, but no thing whatever turns out to be essentially important in the foreverness of the no thing, which all of us essentially are. Now, this is what I'm trying to offer here, you know, not really, I can't ever call myself an expert like Shankara or the Buddha or some of the great sages, but just offering a different point of view to our normal dealing with many things. Most of us deal with many things, multiplicity, from the time you wake up in the morning. You know, go to the refrigerator, you take something out, you put it in the toaster maybe. Or, you know, you deal, you know, maybe you go down and you sit down in your chair and you do your meditation or whatever. you deal with many. And not so many of us are used to dealing with the one thing, which we are. Because it seems so simple, and then in a way, at the same time, so out of reach, that it's hard to grasp. And really, we don't want to grasp it, we want to be it. And we already are it, and we want to know that we are it. So I'll maybe do things a little differently. I'm not going to have a long program here tonight. We really can keep learning, you know. And I'm sure the planetary logos has a lot of humility when you stop to think about the tiny little speck of dust that is the vehicle of the planetary logos. And we human beings, we just get all puffed up about our initiatory this and our initiatory that and initiatory status and all that. And it's just a joke. But eventually, whatever seems to have been taken apart into multiplicity returns to the oneness and the identicality. That's another one of those good words. And you just realize that I won't even call it the universe. I was going to say, well, the universe is as good as it can be. But it's something more than that. It's that which has become the universe is as good as it can be. So we're being trained in the kind of sensitivity which reveals the underlying wholeness, so the underlying being. Trained. We don't need training to recognize multiplicity. We need training, of course, to understand how the units in all of this complexity all relate to each other. We need training that way. But in the initiate consciousness toward which we are all moving, there's something deeper than the relational universe. And this relates to this, to this, to this, to this, in this way and that way, in this way and that way. There's something deeper. And it is beyond the relational universe. It's even beyond the relations of absolute infinitude. It is the absolute one that we probably should call really the no thing, or maybe absolute zero. It's zero when it comes to the forms that we're used to dealing with. There just are no forms which are essential constituents of the absolute zero. Somehow the absolute zero has become all forms without having any form within it. You know, we get into trouble with prepositions and before, behind, within, without, above, below, and all that. We get into trouble when we think about positions and all that, mostly because of boundaries. So now we're going to, after I just welcome you, happy to see you here, and hopefully this, I'm hearing bells, you know, so I hope that it's not interfering with you. So Anna, hi, and Anne, and Annette, and Brennan, and Catherine, Damien, George, Heike and Judy, Karen, Launa, Lorraine, Mariusz, Martha Callahue, yes, Mary Bell, Anessa, Risto, Stacia, Stephen, Renneberg, Vera, and Anne Veronica. And over here on the other side, Joe and Michael are helping as they can, and Tuya is there too. And looks like we switched over to something else. Okay. Let me get to something that's, those bells are bothering me, and Joe, it's not Skype. I don't know. Maybe one day someone will tell me why I'm hearing bells. Okay. So, boundaries. Now, if I was to just ask you, without getting too much into it, what is a boundary? And what are the implications of the existence of boundaries? I remember, you know, we've got this very first fundamental of the secret doctrine. We've got the boundless immutable principle, very first fundamental. So obviously, we're going to have to deal with boundaries and boundlessness. So if you'd like to give your thought on that, or write something, you know, this would be the moment. What is a boundary to you? How is it formed? What are the implications of the fact that boundaries might exist or not exist? You can, I just, you know, we'll have a couple of minutes of silence, and in that silence, you can write, or you can raise your hand because you'd like to speak about it. Boundary. I know it's you know, kind of a strange question, but think of it. The Tibetan Blavatsky begins the secret doctrine with the idea of the principles, fundamentals, and boundary is the very first thing. So here is Vera. Go ahead, Vera.
From more practical purposes, functional, the boundary is like a sphere of control. It helps to, in that practical manifestation, lower mind, it serves the purpose of delineating the control where the work needs to be done. Yeah, that's my first thinking. Not so much in psychological, but in more practical sense.
Yeah, we can come at it in different ways. And surely a boundaryless wholeness is not within the control of any being, except maybe this deity, you know, the absolute deity. Okay, so that's a sphere of control, okay? And that's fine. Any other thoughts? Whoopsie. Sorry. Other thoughts? Anybody that you might like to either speak out or write down or whatever? And then I'll tell you what, then I'm gonna have a special meeting with the experts to get these bells out of my head. Now, I know some of you think that they're just there, but I do believe the program is producing them, and I'm shocked every time. Okay, boundaries. And here is, let's see. So here's Anne and saying, boundaries, perhaps on the spiritual path, boundaries like veils define and help focus the aspirant on what is needed to be learned at the present moment or the current phase. Yeah, well, the whole idea of, I want to just say, focus. It's really important because, again, without what we usually call a boundary, focus is not possible on any one thing. Now, you know, it is interesting whether, I mean, obviously, I'm getting to the point to have to say, do boundaries really exist? You know, that's the issue. Okay, and so thank you, Anne, on that. And Julia, boundary does not exist in reality, but is a means of limiting, says Judy, what one is looking at or speaking about to see it more closely. Like a virtual microscope. And I think there's some important things there, Judy. I would just say, does there exist a normal, observable it without boundaries? You see, because where does it end and something else begin? I think you can see where I'm going with this. But certainly the whole issue of it exists in Maya. A boundary exists in the great Maha Maya. Every universe is the great illusion. Now, that's not how the Tibetan deals with it. He's much closer to home in a way. And he said, yeah, there's a great illusion, and it's mostly caused by people thinking incorrectly and being influenced by their misguiding emotions when they are thinking about reality and so forth. So he's looking at illusion as a kind of a mistake, you know. And but on the other hand, illusion is somewhat inevitable because we, let's just say, I wanted to say this, okay? I'm going to say something here, that finitude is an illusion. So, in other words, and we have to ask, you know, what makes things finite, countable. You know, in mathematics, there's countableness and uncountability, and those are little difficult concepts. It has something to do with the structure of a of the kind of set of things, set of things that you are dealing with. But you know, you could, if it took time to count, you could just go on forever in any infinite series. Even if you had a starting point, you'd go on forever. So a boundary has a lot to do. I don't want to say too much yet. I want to see what you say. Yes, I'll leave it at that. And Lorraine, it's a change in vibrational state. So that's pretty practical. And I believe it's correct. Or distinction of vibrational state. And of course, you have to say, what's vibrating? You know, and what is vibrating is usually some ultimate particle. I used to call them, maybe I still do, UPEs, ultimate particle event. When you look at the cosmic physical plane, you look for its smallest unit. It's not necessarily the smallest thing in cosmos. You know, cosmos is way beyond the cosmic physical plane. So it seems that Leadbeater and Besant, in their monumental research, called this a bubble in the coilon. Okay. So, distinction of vibration, and then the question is, does a bubble in the coilon vibrate? And it would seem that everything, at least on the cosmic physical plane, vibrates. So how small is small? And we know that the thing, you know, in the world of Maya, the things on the cosmic physical plane, all 343 subplanes, they're all aggregates. And the Buddha comes along and says, that which is aggregated shall be de-aggregated. In other words, if it comes together, it's going to go apart. So at least we have all of these combinations. And it seems to me that vibration, none of them escapes the phenomena of vibration. Matter of fact, there's a big question about the rapidity of their appearance, disappearance, and how they seem to go to another level. It's just a repeat of a human being's reincarnation. Okay, you know, my old teacher used to say, we, you know, look around at the people, and he talked about the people that used to be, and he'd say, where are they now? You know, obviously a much longer cycle, but they've been abstracted, and then they are put back in, abstracted. You know, when you get to such things as a bubble in the coilon, or something even smaller, called, that I call at least, an ultimate particle event, the rapidity of the in and out and abstraction, manifestation, abstraction, manifestation must be an astonishing number. And the question is, does it go on as we rise into the next level we call the cosmic astral plane and the cosmic mental plane, faster and faster and faster? And what is the, in all the universe, this universe, let's say, what is the smallest allowable particle, which also requires time? And we don't know, unless we want to call it, like, you know, the ultimate particle event for the universe. You could always make it smaller if the will of the universal logos allowed. But I've come to the conclusion that the universal logos measures out what is allowable and what is not. Now, I've mentioned this before, and maybe you remember that the word Maya means measurable. Maya means that which can be measured. So obviously, you know, somewhere and somehow, there have to be things which have no extension or duration in time, duration in space, and are not measurable. Well, we'll get into the implications of that when we talk about collapsing universes and expanding universes. And, you know, I know that if this, the astrophysicist were to once had the pleasure of taking an hour and a half walk with an astrophysicist, and I think we could communicate. And there were just so many questions that the state of development of that discipline could not provide answers for. And as for what this nice man thought about what I was talking about, I have no idea. He was very polite, you know, so who knows? But when you get into metaphysics, metaphysics, beyond physics per se, you get into questions which even very advanced physics has not yet answered. And it will have to, very advanced physics will have to become metaphysics of a cautious and regulated kind before those questions can be answered. In other words, the physicists, and there are already some, will have to become the esotericists. But you see, this question of distinction of vibration means there's multiplicity. In other words, this is vibrating slower than that. This and that, this and that. See? So one of the first things you do in Vedanta, you know, coming from the Vedas, as it were, is get rid of this and get rid of that. But our perception introduces multiplicity into our consciousness, and we see a lot of different things. Maybe because of the influence of the concrete mind, we see a lot of different things bounded upon each other. But just, you know, take a look around you and at this and that. Compare this and that. I'm looking at a statue of Kuan Yin right now. Too, he has some beautiful streams of tradition and thought here in this Temple of Silence. Or I'm looking at a statue of the Mary, the Mother of Jesus, and she's against a tanka, a kind of cloth painting, Buddhist art, and I know in my normal consciousness that Mary, that statue, is not the Tanka. They are with each other, against each other, but there seems to be a boundary between them, material, vibrational, whatever you want to call it in the world of Maya. There's a difference. Now, run right back to your fundamentals, and we just find out that in the no thing, there's no differences, no articulations, no extension. In fact, we call it sometimes eternal duration, but what are you measuring that duration against? In order to measure, you have to have at least two, and you don't. So all around this temple, I'm looking at boundaries, where this is not that. This is apparently not that, because there seems to be a line of demarcation which separates this from that. And we remember, you know, however you want to apply it, that the one great heresy is the great heresy of separateness. Now, usually we apply that to a human being and we say, oh, that's a separative person and selfish and all that. But now I'm talking about a more philosophical approach to the idea of separation. There's, one of Blavatsky's friends was a certain Dr. Anna Kingsford, who was a very intelligent woman, a medium, and she died very young and, you know, went out in the rain and caught pneumonia. And I wonder if I can, find her, because in it, in this footnote, okay. No, it's not here, not here. And I mean, it is here. That's the trouble. It's one of those footnotes. And I just want to see if I can find it, because she's talking to a higher source, and you know how channeling usually is. It's your own subconscious mind in 96% of the occasions. Kingsford shouldn't be, no? I'm disappointed that I cannot find this as rapidly as I thought. It's in the Alice Bailey extracts, and basically the idea behind it is the higher source says, well, the whole reason for the universe is so that God would not be alone. You know, I mean, of course, it's explained in a kind of a way that maybe it's expected human beings can understand. But the idea was so that God could be other than God. In other words, God would only be God, and there would be no other. Does that mean God would be lonely? I don't know. But if there was to be anything that would relieve God from being only itself, It would have to be the finite universe, which God became. So I'm going to go do a search on this, and it was very interesting that the source that Anna Kingsford was communicating with was not all that eager to dialogue with her on this subject. He says, this is a subject that we planned to withhold from you for quite a while. We weren't going to discuss it. I'm just hoping that there's some kind of no hits with the query, and just look up her life. It's very interesting, and I just don't know how could I be misspelling it. It might be Kings. Well, that's not going to be much. That's going to be something else. No. All right, I'll do my best to find it, because I know I have it, and it's very philosophical. Very philosophical. And it basically gets down to what I would say the need of the infinite to be finite as well as infinite. Now think about that for just a minute. Can the infinite be truly infinite if it is not finite as well? Because then it would be leaving something out of its absolute infinitude, you see. So anyway, she took it down. And, you know, Blavatsky really trusted her greatly. And Blavatsky was either a becoming arhat of the fourth degree, or he was already there, you know. So I'll find it for you, and maybe my friends Michael and Joe and BL can prod me so I don't forget. Now, continuing with Lorraine, in terms of physical vision, color boundaries represent different energies. Yes, emitted by electrons changing there. Yes, it's all about distinction and vibration. The whole purpose of vibration is distinction. We might say in our own terms of our own solar system, the hammer of Vulcan hits the anvil of Mula Prakriti with different degrees of intensity and produces differentiation and distinction through vibration of that which is differentiated. So, like I say, you're looking at the many. Okay. And we'll cyclically forever look at the many, but unless we can resolve the many into the one, then we're still missing something. Okay, let me just go on here. I'm finding it most convenient too. In terms of the evolving individual, says Lorraine, the ring pass not represents a vibrational level with which that evolving unit has not yet resonated to a significant state. So we sometimes talk about the door of initiation, and unless you can present your own vibrational quality as a replica of what's going on the other side of the door, you cannot pass through the door. So that brings us to the idea that we have to become the initiate first. The initiate is initiate before he or she is initiated. So there's always a standard, and DK has been very good at giving us those standards, the kind of vibration we have to show within our instrument before we can pass beyond the ring pass knot, which generally is a vibrational phenomena presenting the next higher level of activity, consciousness, registration, whatever. Is there a continuity? Well, you know, that problem in mathematics, from what I understand, is the most difficult. The problem of the continuum. You know, and then, of course, we have the idea of the quantum leap, which no longer necessitates a continuum. But how do you solve the problem of the continuum in which there is a steady flow and no breaks, hiatus between stage one and stage two, phase two and stage three and so forth? A lot of I don't think it's been solved, at least not mathematically, and maybe esoterically it has been somewhat solved. Okay, so Heike is saying boundaries is form giving on any level of perception. I think that's a very, that's a good one. Because remember that the no thing, the boundless immutable principle, is formless and unbounded at the same time. It's boundless, which means that it has to be formless, because there's nothing else. You need something else if there's going to be a boundary, don't you? And there's nothing else. The one without a second, and that doesn't refer to a unit of time, it refers to a number two. That's it, that's all, that's it. My old teacher, well, if only I had been sharp enough in those days to get it. But he would always say, you know, with such earnestness, like, can anybody get it? This is it. This is it. He didn't mean all the multiplicity. He meant the beingness of the thisness. I'll be locked up for abuse of words. The beingness of thisness or thatness. Depends on how you want to use those words. Remember, the Vedanta say, thou art that, meaning, you know, there's nothing here immediately in front of you that you are. It's the thatness of the thisness that you are. You are the thatness of the thitness, thisness. Don't tell jokes. This is it. That is it. The thatness of the thisness is being or beingness. Now, what I like about Ike's presentation is it introduces the idea of perception. Now, unless, this is my view anyway, all I can do is present that if the absolute deity as distinct from absoluteness, apparently distinct, did not observe itself through the power of, well, what do I want to call it? Reductive will or willing reductiveness. You know, it's like a valve. Valve getting smaller and smaller and smaller. That's emanation. See? This great, great universal being keeps on reducing the valve of its own perception until it just stops out of its own will because it knows that it itself is finite and it cannot ever produce an infinitude within a finite universe. So unless that self-observation occurred, there would be nothing except itself. And we're going to come back to the idea that God is all in all, our universal God is all in all, when all valvular reductions of its sight return to full self-sight. Just think about that for a minute. See, the universe itself is a self-perception of the absolute deity. And all the things within the universe are self-observations of the universal logos, the universal God. That finite God observing itself produces other finitudes. It doesn't produce infinity. The only actualizable infinity exists on the level of the absolute deity beyond the universe. Within universe, no actualizable infinitudes. Now, you know, it seems like, well, this is really pretty remote. I'm a human being here. I have to pay my rent. I have to take care of my car. You know, I have to live a healthy life if I possibly can. What are we talking about? Why are we talking about these things? Because, you know, we're talking about these things because we're talking about you. We're talking about the archetypal you, I want to say this German word, Uralte. You know, I think it means like archetypal, but the ancient primeval you. you in reality. Now, some people could be careless about that, and other people want to get a little bit to the bottom of it, a little more. So when this great being observes itself through different apertures, which are controlled by its will, then forms appear as part of the emanative process. So finitude, says Judy, is a limitation placed on conscious perception, and it's a self-chosen limitation. It begins with what, you know, it's quite a question. What can the absolute deity see? And I've come up with two things. It can see the homogeneous oneness. Now, this type of sight cannot be achieved within that oneness, within that absoluteness, only one grade lower, as it were. And it can see the absolute infinitude which it is in articulation. So it can see all of it, can see the one, it's itself as the one, and the many, 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 you know what I mean? Infinite many. So the finitude is a choice of this absolute deity. And the placement is only by itself. There's nothing else out there to control it. In other words, it's the first actor. We cannot say that the absolute is the actor. We've got to call it the beer. It's not an actor. It just is what it is forever. But then comes the cyclic emergence of the reflection of the absolute. By what means, who knows? And then you get the actor. And from the time you get the actor, you get the most transcendent God. Now, the absolute is not a God. It's something, it's the essentiality out of which gods emerge. So, Catherine, a preconceived sphere of influence. I almost forgot what I'm looking at here. The whole idea is, what is a boundary? It is a sphere of influence. Now, that's important, Catherine, because is absolute infinitude bounded by any kind of sphere? A universe is, but absolute infinitude is post and pre-universe, forever. And it's not bounded. Now, it's really hard for a human being to, if we think of a thing, it's the very boundedness of the self-perception which produces that thing. There are no things without boundaries. Thingness requires vibrational boundedness or some sort of perceptual differentiation. Lorraine was calling it, you know, vibration. some kind of perceptual differentiation. But absolute non-boundedness, how can you conceive it? Just means there's, you know, never an end. And as many articulations or differentiations as can be witnessed by this absolute deity when it witnesses itself, that's how many they are, and they're, it's just a lot of infinite series, and finally an absolutely infinite condition. And inconceivable, I think, to us, except we know it's not a sphere. Because if it was a sphere, it would be a boundary. And there is no boundary in the boundless immutable principle. The first time that is seen or registered, as it has been forever, is by the absolute deity. So, yeah, thought, we can say with Judy, thought creates a boundary. And we can also say a deliberate reduction, a valvular reduction of perception, of self-perception, creates a boundary. I'm not sure how much we have to cogitate. Depends on what you mean by thought, okay? But, you know, when I'm looking at the chairs in this room, I'm not thinking anything. I'm not, there's no thought. But there are boundaries. And it's because the great deity has looked at itself in a certain self-reductive manner. So really the only choice that this great deity has is to, in a way, see smaller and smaller parts of itself in an isolated way, because the wholeness of itself, it already sees and is. But it's really important to divide at that point the seer from the seen. Now, I've made a promise that I'm not going to go too long. Yes, the thought of a chair. Yes. In that sense, Judy, yes. And then where, you know, this gets into Plato, where did chairness really begin, and what are the archetypal forms? Yes, indeed, you are seeing not necessarily somebody else's thought, because that body is going to be you anyway, but you're seeing thought as generated from a higher level, and it's by a reduction of perception. So higher and higher, it all begins with the divisions, self-divisions. It all begins with number, the self-divisions of a universal logos. And then the combination of those divisions may require thought power and does produce things. So it gets, I think, there's only one great thinker in this cosmos, and that is the universal logos itself. But first, number is required. And then combinations of numbers making aggregations, which are in fact things. So, and in a way, this is going on a much higher level than the cosmic physical plane. You know, we've got our map and all that, but this is going, you know, what really is the height of the universe. And the one great creator, which we are too, is the universal logos when we're talking about a universe. Now, why all this? Can you look around you? Can I look around my apparent self? And despite the many boundaries which inevitably appear, whether you're in a dining room or on the sidewalk or flying in an airplane or whatever, can you take all of these distinctions? Let's try this. Take these distinctions which appear in your consciousness. And can you negate the apparent lines of separation so that the one is not compartmentalized? You know, there's no my soul, thy soul, the being of this, the being of that. It's all one being. Despite the walls which appear as you look at the many, can you pervade those walls with something that overcomes them and demonstrates that they are really illusory? And now the tricky part is, of course, it means you still have to function in the world of Maya as if the walls existed. See, there's only one substance. It's not like, you know, substance is matter and all the rest of it. It's the one substanding one. And that one substanding one always has to be present, regardless of who you think you are. And can you find a way, try to do this as I talk about it, to wipe out boundaries in your normal field of vision or audio or tactile or whatever sense we're talking about? Can you wipe out boundaries by finding the fact that because these things are, they are the same? What I'm saying is a somewhat preposterous idea, but okay. All things that are the same. And all things that are self-observations, starting with the super-universal deity. In other words, if two things of very different in quality are, they are the same, most essentially. Not qualitatively, no. Not qualitatively, but existentially the same. If you see a beautiful picture of the Christ in his hierarchy, and then you see a picture of a muddy road, very different in the world of Maya, but there's a way to find an essence that tells us that because they are the same. If any two things, 100 things, 1 quadrillion things are, meaning they be, they are the same. Now, you know, you just can't leave that as a formulation of words. It has to be tested out, has to be deeply pondered. You have to find the open door. The form negating door, without negating the ability to practically handle that which is negated. Find the door that negates difference. Practice a little bit every day until, like the great initiates, one day again you can see it, experience it, you can know that it is the truth. Yeah, there, because I have to stop soon. Are there any burning questions or statements that you want to make? Now, of course, look, I'm expecting that everyone will practice, because if you don't practice, you want to see a pianist who's almost a perfect pianist. Nothing's perfect, but if you turn on your YouTube and you look at some of the concerts of Vladimir Horowitz, sort of Libra Scorpio, and you just can't believe what you're seeing or hearing. Okay, practice. Paderewski, he was a Polish diplomat, but he was also a great pianist. So the statement is, if I don't practice for one day, I notice it. If I don't practice for 2 days, my musician friends notice it. And if I don't practice for 3 days, everybody notices it. So although this is another kind of curriculum, it has to be practiced. And of course, as I always say, you got to read DK as long as you're under his influence, and gather what you can from spiritual relativism, his approach. Okay, I'm looking because I'm going to stop very shortly. You know, and I just, and don't think that it is impossible to overcome boundaries, because you've done it countless times. You could say, well, look, it's very Neptunian. It's a mystical approach. Okay, in some ways, yes. But it is a great fundamental to resolve the many into the one, which they are anyway. So, sorry that it's necessary to leave a little early tonight. But, you know, it's late here and many other requirements are knocking at the door. And, you know, give it that 5 or 10 minutes every day. And hold up, like I said, a couple of different things against each other. And practice finding that ontological sameness, ontological, you know, having to do with the science of being, ontological sameness. Now, as I say, our service requires multiplicity, and it requires that we deal with relativity all the time. Okay, and that's good, and we will. But running as a parallel stream is the quest for ontological sameness. And we've found it before, and we are it. And it's always probably going to be a surprise when it hits us, but I think it will improve the life of relativity if we could, you know, kind of do this at will. So do your best. Now, as I seem to have promised, for many good reasons, let's do this together. But, you know, keep yourself on mute, even though you would be doing it out loud. The great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, Let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Here, you can carry your ohms much further. I get this cough when I try to do an extended ohm, so just carry on, you know. Tomorrow morning, Science of the Triangles. Tomorrow evening, the Triangles Meditation. Then the next evening, we'll have the broadcast for Reappearance of the Christ. And then on Friday, we'll have nothing in the morning, but evening will be, gosh, what will it be? Glamour. And then also, I do believe we'll be working a little more on the secret doctrine. We'll see. We have a time coming up now when the conference will be offered, and even though those of you who are in the Esoteric United Nations, we said we'll keep going with that, you know, 5-10 minutes a day, or 2 and 5 minutes a day, even during the conference. And if you would like to take a pledge to uphold this daily tuning in on the needs of the different nations of the world and their energies, where they are given or when we can figure them out, then write to Tuya and to me. And we'll also give you an address that you can write to. I'm not sure, is Tuya there? Where can people write? I have something strange going on with my, you're self-muted.
Did you ask from me, Michael?
Yeah, I said, what is our esoteric United Nations Gmail address?
Esoteric United Nations at gmail.com.
Okay, so one word, Esoteric United Nations, like that?
Like that. Right, yeah.
At gmail.com. So
and gmail.
Yeah, so if you're interested in, you know, helping in this way, there's so many ways we can help, you know. So. And the next 5 years, as you can already see, if the counterforce does not make the kind of progress it wants to make during the next 5 years, then they will not succeed in delaying the externalization of the hierarchy and the reappearance of the Christ. DK said such a delay could last 300 years. Somewhere he said that, I think, in Psych 1. And although it seems a small amount of time to the person that's experiencing it, it's a long time. So let's hope to relieve humanity's obstacles in our own little way and make it possible for the soul of humanity to express. And I think in the chat box are some times that you can just copy the whole thing and then sort it out later, you know. Thank you for being here tonight for us and other times for you, as we continue to do what we couldn't do 50 years ago and be connected with each other in this way. So lots of love, many blessings from the whole team, and we'll be talking to you.